Hi, I'm Jessica Steinberg.
And I'm Amanda Borchel Dunn. Welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing.
Your update on what's important in Israel, the Middle East,
and the Jewish world. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Daily Briefing. Today is Wednesday, August 3rd. Amanda Borchel Dunn here, joined by our political correspondent, Tal Schneider, and our legal affairs reporter, Jeremy Sharon. Hello to you both.
Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Amanda.
I'm back after a two-week break and ready to be caught up. Thanks so much to Anne Gordon for taking up the mic while we were gone. Today, we'll talk politics and hear about Tal's interview with Ram head Mansour Abbas. We'll also learn about the potentially precedent-setting case of the Mizpeh Kramim settlement and the High Court ruling last week. First off, former Prime Minister Netanyahu held a press conference this morning. Briefly, Tal, what did he announce?
Yes, Amanda, it was not really a press conference. It was more of a statement pre-recorded on a video. It was very interesting, to my opinion, because he presented an economic plan, something the Likud did not present for many years. We did not have a written or videotaped platform by the Likud for so many years. One of the reasons was that the Likud kept on saying, at least since 2009, they kept saying, we don't need to present a written platform as we show the public what we do. And if you want to vote for us, just, you know, go by our actions. Don't go by our written statements. Again, I said, this is rare because all of his campaigns in the past were on national security issues. We saw a public polling in the recent month saying Israeli public doesn't take any more interest in Iran or the Palestinian issue. All they care about is consumer price, housing crisis, housing very, very high prices, the, you know, the prices of gas, the huge crisis in the education system, and so on.
So in the past, in early years of his premiership, he was actually known as an economic savior for Israel. And do you think he's just trying to get back that kind of branding?
Yes, you're talking about the year of 1996 to 1999, where his economic impact was huge on the state of Israel. But between 2009 and 2021, where he was the prime minister for 12 years, consecutive 12 years, actually the consumer prices and the housing crisis soared. He was very focused on Iran and on national security issues, which are obviously very, very important in Israel. He was not really focused. And he actually admitted that. He said in 2015 or 16 in several interviews, I am to be blamed for not focusing enough on the housing problem. So it's not like he was really focused on the things. Prices went up really high during those years. He now blames the former government, you know, the outgoing government, the change government. He blames them for the soaring prices of the housing in the last 12 months. And you know, obviously, the prices of the housing in the last 12 months really soared up, like many places around the world. And, you know, my opinion is that they were in power for a year. It's hardly enough to change, you know, course in any country. And he has to take responsibility for the 12 years before that year. You can't really drop everything on them. But obviously, they didn't do any good on that front. And that's, you know, he's playing on that.
Okay, Tal, staying with you. You held an on-stage interview with Ram head Mansour Abbas this weekend in which he said he hopes that the current coalition will remain in power following the upcoming November 1st elections. I understand that things got pretty spicy there with protesters and people saying that Ram supports terror. Tell us all about the event.
Yeah, actually, Mansour Abbas, who is a resident of Israel's Galilee, up northern village of Muslims and Druze and so on, came to my city, Ramat HaSharon, which is a very secular, liberal suburb of Tel Aviv. We are holding Saturday night sort of meet the press live events once in a month before the election and also after the election. And he was my invitee for this Saturday morning live show. The crowds was full. I mean, we had a full house like never before. It goes to show you the huge interest the Israeli liberals and secular and probably most of them lefty, the interest they have in this politician. Lots of people are curious about him because he's coming from a religious Islamic movement party. This is very different. And he is such a soft-spoken person. he sat on the stage, and I was trying to get out of him, will he sit with the Likud next time? Because he was negotiating with both sides, if you remember, early days of 2021. And I was trying to say, you know, on the fifth election, will you negotiate with both sides? Will you sit with the Likud? And he said, well, I don't want to boycott anyone. That's his basic core principle, opposed to the Likud, who keeps saying that they will boycott him. He says, I am not going to boycott them. But I have to tell you, I feel more comfortable with this change government. I thought this change government should continue, and I will do my utmost to continue with them. If you check the polls at the moment, it looks like they don't have the numbers. However, the Likud doesn't have the numbers as well. So all of the political analysts would tell you that either side will have to negotiate with Mansour Abbas, no matter what the numbers are and no matter what Netanyahu keeps saying. You know, the Likud is trying to portray him as a terror supporter. He is taking a lot of offense from that. It's very insulting to him because obviously he said to the crowds, people asked him, you know, straightforward, are you a terror supporter? He said, no. If I was, you know, anything close to that, you think the Israeli security operation would not stop me? This is unbelievable to be just called, to be called, you know, this name calling. And after the session came to an end, he went off the stage and approached one of the people who was there, who is a father who lost his son in combat in Israel, is a resident of our city. And he went to him and spoke to him in person. As you said, it was some of the crowds outside did not like the fact that Mansour Abbas came to speak at a local hall that is basically dedicated to the fallen soldiers. So this was the reason for the demonstration out there. And I have to tell you, everybody know that we also have fallen soldiers who are Druze and Bedouin. The latter are Muslims. So he is representing actually the Bedouin community of Israel, who is also serving in the military. They have fallen soldiers, not specifically in our city, but around the country. And he was, you know, he said, I will come to speak wherever, you know, I will respect any location. And the city and the mayor of our town totally supported the fact that he can speak at this specific hall, but it didn't go without any tension.
Okay, now part of the parties that are really against having any kind of negotiations with Mansour Abbas are, of course, Otzma Yehudit and religious Zionism. Jeremy, talk to us about the imminent or potentially imminent merger between these far-right parties.
So the far-right religious Zionism party, headed by Bezalel Smotrich, has been in negotiations with the ultranationalist and Jewish supremacist Otzma Yehudit party, or Jewish Power in English, headed by MK Itamar Ben-Gvir, and they've been negotiating over the past few weeks. This is actually familiar territory for both parties, since they ran on joint electoral lists in the last elections and in previous rounds as well. So right now, the negotiations have become especially tricky and somewhat fraught because the process has an extra wrinkle. And that is that the ultra-nationalist outfit, Otzma Yehudit, have been doing very well in the polls. And Itamar Ben-Gvir has become very popular. And in some of the recent polls, Otzma has even outperformed the more established and mainstream religious Zionist party. So this has given Otzma extra traction in the negotiations. And Smotrich has taken some time to come to terms with this new reality and has been dragging his feet for several weeks, knowing he has to improve the offer he's previously made, in which Otzma didn't get as many seats, didn't get as many positions in the electoral list, in the joint electoral list for the Knesset. So in a rather bizarre turn of events just the other day, religious Zionism apparently leaked the contents of the latest offer they made to Otzma to the Channel 12 News main evening broadcast. And during that broadcast, Itamar Ben-Gvir sent off a statement to the press saying, I accept that offer. Thank you very much, Bezalel. That's great. And he accepted that offer. And seemingly, you know, a deal was done. Now, in the kind of day and a half since that incident, there's been continuing squabbling. This time, it's over the seventh position on the list. The offer made by religious Zionism to Otzma is that they divide the first 10 spots on the list equally. So each gets five candidates from each party on the joint list, although the spot on the seventh list is supposed to be a consensus candidate between both parties. But especially significant is that Religious Zionism offered Itamar Ben-Gvir to be the co-leader of the United Party, which is a very dramatic development given the roots of the Otzma Yehudit Party as a Kahanist party and the successor of Rabbi Meir Kahana's Kach party, which was banned in the 1990s for racism. So the joint list is currently polling at around 10, 11 seats, and that would make it perhaps the fourth largest party in Israel. And then you'd have that party led by this extreme far-right firebrand, Itamar Ben-Gvir. So the negotiations are continuing. Like there's public squabbling between the two sides over the seventh spot. That seems to be the sticking point at the moment. And as far as I'm aware, they haven't discussed who's going to get which ministerial role yet. But it does seem that it is in the interests of both of those parties to run together to maximize their electoral strength. And I think eventually, despite the bickering, they'll get a deal done.
We're going to short break now.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, Daily Briefing listeners. I'm so happy you've joined us for our daily analysis of what's important in Israel, the Middle East, and the Jewish world. Like what you hear? Check out our Times Will Tell weekly podcast. Every Friday, you can hear conversations with authors, artists, archaeologists, and thought leaders from around the globe. Subscribe to Times Will Tell, our weekly half-hour feature, wherever you find your podcasts. Enjoy! And we're back. Jeremy, staying with you, last week in a reversal of a decision from 2 years ago, the High Court of Justice ruled that Mitzpeh Kramim, the settlement outpost that is built on private Palestinian land, can remain in place. The court said that the outpost did not need to be evacuated because the land was actually allocated by the government to the settlers in quote-unquote good faith. What kind of ripple effect could this have?
So what the High Court said in the Mitzpeh Kramim ruling is that the land allocated to the settlers for Mitzpeh Kramim was allocated in good faith by the state back in 1999. And that when that allocation was done in a deal with the Barak government and the settler movement, the state was unaware of the Palestinian claims to the plot of land in question. And so what the High Court said was that the settlement should be allowed to remain in place because it was established in good faith, and also added that compensation should be given to anyone who can prove their land ownership. So what the ripple effects are is that both the proponents of the settlements and the opponents of the settlement movement say that the High Court ruling will enable between 2,000 to 3,000 existing settlement homes currently built on Palestinian land or land which has Palestinian claims to it to be legalized using the same tool which the High Court used for the Mitzpeh Kramim case. So on the one hand, this will have a substantial effect on the claims of Palestinians to the land in question, the land on which those 2,000 to 3,000 settler homes are built, and that will obviously affect them significantly. Although we're not talking about massive tracts of land. in relation to those homes. I should also say that the ruling does not give carte blanche to any settler group or settler organization to go and establish a new settlement on Palestinian land and then expect that the High Court will approve that land seizure. The court and the justices clearly wrote in their decision that the reason the Mitzpeh Kerem was being legalized was that it was built in good faith. The state did not know there was a legitimate Palestinian claim to the land. If like a few weeks ago, a settlement organization sent thousands of activists to set up outposts all around the country. Now, if that in the future, those outposts were taken down, but if in the future an outpost would be established on private Palestinian land at the whim of some settlement organization, they would have to prove that they did not know that this was private Palestinian land and that they had done all necessary investigations to ensure it wasn't private Palestinian land. So the court ruling is in no way giving a blanket dispensation to seize any Palestinian land that they may feel like taking. And so the effect will be restricted, bearing in mind those parameters.
Now, Tal, ending with you, finally, for the first time in Israel's history, a woman entered the role of military secretary to the president's office. Tell us about Brigadier General Naama Rosen Greenberg.
Yeah, right, Amanda. A good progress for women of Israel. Naama Rosen Greenberg was promoted to Brigadier General, and she replaced Brigadier General Ala Abu Rukon, who was the former secretary of the president, and he is also coming from the Druze community, a great achievement by itself. But for women in Israeli military, it's much more difficult. She's coming from the intelligence community, a place where they have more women than other units. According to data that we have, at least half of the women that are enlisted to the intelligence community are women. But when you get to the higher ranks, it is coming down to 16% only. And one of the goals of the military, as you know, a stated goal of the military, is have at least, you know, 30% women in top ranks. This is coming from the chairman of the intelligence forces, Aaron Khaliva, just recently in a story that we broke in Times of Israel and Zman Israel. She is, you know, we don't know much about her. We only got her photo with the president and the Israel chief of staff, Aviv Kochavi, getting the ranks. And, you know, the role of the military secretary for the president, it is an important role because, as we know, this current president is a world traveler, a world, you know, engaged leader. He's here for the next 6 years. He's already finalized his first year in power, where you have a situation where governments shift every year or every 6 months. He is a persistent, you know, politician who is not going away for the next 6 years. And we do see leaders around the world treat Herzog with much more respect than you would expect, because obviously the president doesn't have executive power at all in Israel. It is supposed to be just a symbolic role, but with the political situation and with the crisis in the political arena, Herzog became much more prominent than you would think. He engaged with the Turkish president and kind of put the Israeli-Turkey relationship back on track after 10 years of huge problems. The president of China, she actually called him and not called the prime minister. He's patching problems with Poland. He's patching problems with Hungary. So being the military secretary of the president it's an important role. And we are happy that, you know, a woman is fulfilling the spot for the first time.
All right. Thank you for that, Tal. Tal, Jeremy, thanks for joining me. Listeners, join us again for tomorrow's daily briefing and more updates on Israel, the Middle East, and the Jewish world. Till now, shalom. Thank you.
Thank you, Amanda.
Pleasure. Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. And thanks to our producer, Gilad Brownstein, and to Gili Amar for this out-of-this-world music.
You can find us daily wherever you find your podcasts.
And on our mothership, timesofisrael.com. Like what you hear? Consider rating us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify to spread the word.
And be sure to check out our weekly feature, Times Will Tell, released every Friday. Until next time.
Shalom.